No one can explain what good could possibly come from revoking DACA, not even the administration that has announced that it's revoking DACA.
Hi, I'm Carrie Budoff-Brown, editor of Politico. And that voice you just heard was Cecilia Munoz, our guest on this episode of Women Rule. Cecilia worked in President Obama's White House as the Domestic Policy Council director, where she was the highest-ranking Latina in the West Wing. She was also the architect for years of the modern strategy around comprehensive immigration reform. She had a key role in crafting DACA, the Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals. This is that program built in 2012 that we've heard so much about in the last week. It granted work permits to undocumented immigrants who arrived in the country as children, and it basically put off any attempts to deport them while this program existed. But President Trump, last week, decided to put an end to the program, and he gave Congress 6 months to come up with a solution. When we spoke with Cecilia, who is now the Vice President of Policy and Technology at a progressive think tank, New America, she said she was still going through the stages of grief over Trump's decision, but she also had sharp advice for congressional Democrats about how to save Dreamers, the nearly 800,000 recipients of DACA who can now face deportation. I hope you stay tuned for that conversation. On the Women Rule podcast, we'll be bringing you backstage conversations with women leaders, the big bosses in politics and policy. If you're a fan of the show, please subscribe to Women Rule on Apple Podcasts or wherever you get your podcasts. Rate us and leave a review. And please share our episodes on social media and follow me on Twitter at C. Budoff Brown. Women Rule is produced by Politico in partnership with our founding partners, Google and the Tory Burch Foundation. And now a word from our presenting sponsor, Chevron. When more girls go into science, technology, engineering, and math, the whole world benefits. With support from families, schools, policymakers, businesses, girls can do remarkable things with STEM. Chevron is proud to join Women Rule in empowering the next generation of female leaders. Now let's get to our talk with Cecilia Munoz. Cecilia, thank you so much for joining us on Women Rule.
Thank you for having me.
It's great for you to be here, particularly at this moment, right? It's been a week, almost a week, more than a week since President Trump announced his decision on, you know, the Dreamers, as we call them, the Deferred Action Program that he's decided to rescind. And in addition to that, give Congress 6 months to do something about it.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm curious for you, as somebody who was, you know, working on this issue for so long and just knows the contours of Washington and how it works, are you more or less optimistic a week later about the chances of Congress doing something this time?
It's difficult to say. I'm kind of working through some stages of grief, to be honest. I've definitely arrived at anger.
Because what was the first stage?
Well, the first stage was just profound sadness that, that this is... I mean, we're talking about 800,000 people. They are young people by definition. They grew up here by definition. And for most of them don't remember the countries that they were born in. So the anxiety on their part of what this might mean for their lives is sort of unimaginable. But also there's no one can explain what good could possibly come from revoking DACA. Not even the administration that has announced that it's revoking DACA. It doesn't help anybody at all. And it hurts not just the DACA recipients and their families and their communities, but it hurts local economies and the national economy actually pretty profoundly. So here's like huge harm and no benefit at all. That's crazy and ugly and, you know, and a lot of worse things.
So now that you're at the stage of anger, when do you get to the point of assessing sort of clear-eyed, what are the chances now? And really, how do the immigrant rights advocates sort of seize this moment?
Well, we have to seize the legislative moment. There's a legislative opportunity really for the simple reason that folks in Congress can't escape the fact that they have constituents who are affected by this and many, many, many more constituents who really care about it. I mean, DACA polls off the charts among Democrats and Republicans. And There is no state that is not affected by this. And these are some of the most compelling stories you'll ever hear. So the pressure on Congress to act is very high. You know, it's difficult to assess the likelihood of action in a Congress which can barely get up in the morning. But the pressure on them to act is going to be very high. And I think it's entirely possible. There's, again, DAC has had bipartisan support for a really long time. We almost got it through Congress in 2010. The dynamics are obviously very different and very difficult to read.
Different than 2010 when
it
passed the Senate.
That's right. It passed the House. It failed the Senate by 5 votes. At the time, there were 11 Republicans in the Senate who had voted for it previously, and most of them didn't vote for it this time, which is why it didn't pass. So on the one hand, if you do that kind of analysis, just the straight up votes, it looks harder, given that this is that there are more anti-immigrant types in the Congress now. On the other hand, this is very different because people are on the brink of having something very important taken away, and they are telling their stories really courageously and really compellingly, and that is a very tough thing to push back against.
So what advice would you give them as somebody who, as you were in the White House for 8 years, a large majority of that was involved in, it was taken up by trying to get Congress to act on immigration.
Yeah.
To talk about how Democrats should approach this. And I, you know, as somebody myself, as you know, I covered immigration starting back in, 2007 or 8 here in Washington. And the Dreamers, as you know, that slice of the population, there was always this desire at various points in these debates to just take that win legislatively for Dreamers. Mm-hmm. And there was always that reluctance over the years because you leave a lot of undocumented immigrants out of that sort of legislative package. And for that reason, you could speak to, you know, this as well, is just that has also led to nothing getting solved over the years. Is it time for Democrats to just take the narrow win?
Yes. And for the simple reason that, again, the difference between the DREAM Act vote from years, the votes that we've had over many years, is that right now these are people who are really being pushed over a cliff. And that the stakes for that are very, very different. So, yes, Democrats, this should be a top priority.
And they should just take a legal, you know, deal with the DREAMers, maybe patch it or align it with something Republicans want and take the win and go? Or,
well, I mean, the tactical situation, I think, is for the members of Congress themselves to discuss. But if I thought there were an opportunity to pass a broader immigration bill, I'd be pushing for a broader immigration bill. I don't think we have that opportunity.
So you don't think Democrats should try to go bigger with this?
Yeah, my particular advice, to the extent that anybody is asking, is to stay focused on the DREAM Act. It's going to be challenging to get that done. Broader immigration reform is, as we all know, pretty complex. We have a short-term opportunity, and you know, immigration reform would likely take longer and has just a lot more moving parts. So that suggests that if were we to tackle broader immigration reform, it would be a very messy, very complicated, big lift that you can't do in 3 months. DREAM Act you can do in 3 months. It's well known. Its terms are well established. And if it doesn't happen, you have a catastrophe. So that is the thing which we think can focus the Congress's mind and attention.
When Donald Trump, the president, tweeted last week that DACA kids don't have to worry about being deported, Do you believe him?
No, I don't believe him, because that's inconsistent with the actions of his Department of Homeland Security. So that may be what he wishes were true, maybe even what he thinks is true, but it's not actually true. The Dreamers know that.
I'd love to go back to that moment when you and others in the White House and the president decided to take this step in 2012. I was a little hung up on the time at the time, as someone who covered the president, that he had said for years, and you would probably disagree with this characterization, that he said for years he couldn't do this, and then he did it. So what, I'd love to hear like the behind the scenes decision making that led up to that at that moment.
So DACA is an extension, it's a use of enforcement authority. It's not actually a benefit program in the traditional sense. It's a use of enforcement authority. So starting in 2009, DHS started to establish a set of priorities for how it wanted to enforce the law. And in Secretary Napolitano's view, the proof of the pudding, whether or not we were being successful in focusing our enforcement resources on people convicted of crimes as opposed to other people, was whether or not we ended up with dreamers in the deportation pipeline. Because these were, for her, in her mind, examples of people you didn't want to be expending enforcement resources on. And the initial steps that DHS took were not enough. Because why? Mm-hmm. Because dreamers kept ending up in the deportation pipeline. So you have a progression that starts in 2009, 2010, that ultimately leads to DACA, because the steps that they had taken up until that point weren't sufficient to keep low priority people out of the deportation mm-hmm. pipeline. So that's how you get to DACA in 2012. The president, look, the reason that he pushed so hard against taking executive action in the first place is for because of what we're experiencing now. He knew and was very clear that anything he had the capacity to do would be less than what we can do through legislation. It could only be temporary. It's not good enough in his view. And he said that on the day that we announced DACA, he was in the Rose Garden saying, these people deserve better than to have to plan their lives in 2-year increments.
I guess a lot of the president's agenda depended on getting a Democrat to succeed him, right?
Well, yes, but look, in the end, you know that you can't expect Democrats to succeed, you know, President Obama forever, yeah. right? So he was clear and we were clear. And this was actually part of what DHS communicated to the people who were applying for DACA. Please understand what this is. Mm-hmm. If you meet the following, if the following things are true about you, you can come forward and say, I'm deportable. Please defer action on my mm-hmm. deportation. But understand that you're giving us your information. And understand that this decision is reversible by some future mm-hmm. administration, that we can't commit future mm-hmm. administrations to doing the same thing. We felt it was really important for people to understand what mm-hmm. it is that they were signing up for. And, you know, even had the 2016 election gone differently, it's still true that somebody could have ended up in the White House that would certainly have the authority to undo this. So we knew that was true. We advised people that it was true, but obviously nobody expected this kind of result. Because frankly, up until now, even the Republicans who have run for the nomination have been supporters of the DREAM Act and mm-hmm. supporters of the Dreamers. This is obviously an unexpected turn of events.
What was that day like for you in 2012 when the announcement happened? I mean, did you feel pride, trepidation, concern, all the above? I mean, I think at that point it was a little bit unclear how politically it would play out for him. But that's just right. You personally, as somebody who worked on this issue for years prior to that in the White House, you were at La Raza where you pushed hard for changes yeah. to the immigration system.
Mm-hmm.
You know, take me to that moment.
So we... There were a lot of very exhausted people, including me, watching that announcement. We'd worked incredibly hard to make the decision. It wasn't an easy decision, for the very reason that you cite. The first layer of the decision was making sure that we were really confident that this was, that the agency could really pull this off. And we had kicked around a set of alternatives just among the White House team. And we were very concerned that if it felt like this was something the White House was asking DHS to do, we weren't sure that they would be able to do it successfully. Mm-hmm. What made the decision easier was when Secretary Napolitano came to us with the DACA proposal. And at that point, we realized, all right, this agency is all in. We think this can happen. We kicked the tires pretty hard on the agency's ability to implement. And that's what teed up the decision. So that was kind of one layer was kicking the tires legally, kicking the tires with respect to being certain that the agency could carry it off. Politically, as you say, we had no idea how it was going to go over. There's a big difference, potentially even with Democrats, between passing something legislatively and using executive authority to do something of this size. It's a use of enforcement authority that presidents before President Obama have done, including President George W. Bush and H.W. Bush, and even back to the Reagan administration. Administrations have used deferred action. But this was a bigger use and a more systematic use. And we weren't sure even that you know, Democrats in tight races would stick with mm-hmm. us on this. We had no idea.
What role will the President Obama, former President Obama, play in this discussion, the 6-month window mm-hmm. where a decision can be made by Congress to legalize?
I don't know the answer to that. I know that he cares tremendously about the Dreamers.
Did you talk to him after this decision?
I haven't talked to him after the decision, but I've obviously spent a lot of time with him on this subject, and I know how passionately mm-hmm. he cares about it. And he gave a very passionate statement after President Trump's announcement mm-hmm. that made his feelings about this very clear. And, you know, people, it's, if we, I think of this as the, you know, people thinking of President Obama as being kind of vested with magical powers, that if he were to just engage with his eloquence, everything would change. You know, nobody is more skeptical than that than President Obama himself.
We'll be right back with more Women Rule. But first, a word from our presenting sponsor, Chevron. When more girls go into science, technology, engineering, and math, the whole world benefits. With support from families, schools, policymakers, businesses, girls can do remarkable things with STEM. Chevron is proud to join Women Rule in empowering the next generation of female leaders.
I'd love to hear from you a little bit now that you have some perspective, having now, I don't know, 8 months out of the White House. With that perspective, what should you have done differently?
Gosh, I don't know the answer to that question yet. If I've learned anything, it's that it's the arc of history is really long, and it's hard to see, even in the time frame that we're talking about, to look back and see what the right actions were. I do know this, that we gave immigration reform, all of us gave it everything we had from the beginning, from the first year. And so I don't have regrets about that. I think it's still too soon for me to really know the answer to that question. I will say that I'm still living with the frustration that I had at the time that I come, as you know, from the immigration advocacy community, that folks pivoted early to executive action and gave up on Congress, frankly, early. I think sooner than
when you say folks,
they should have. Folks in the immigration advocacy community. And, and we had...
The arguments they were making, like they were just Congress...
People just wanted relief. And they made it really clear, we just want it to stop. So President Obama, just take care of this for us. Please, you know, we believe you have the authority, make immigration enforcement stop. And folks in the advocacy community went quite far in the direction of making the argument that, like, immigration enforcement shouldn't ever happen, that there isn't any kind of enforcement that was okay. And I come from that world. I think that was a mistake. Now, it's easy for me to point out, you know, mistakes that I think other people made. But it is a source of great frustration, and we are now living with...
What were the consequences of that at the time?
Well,
in terms of the political environment here,
folks took their foot off the gas with respect to Congress. Now, it may be, and some people argue, that even if they'd kept pressure up on Congress, John Boehner was never going to bring up that bill in the House. And that might be true, but we'll never know.
So now you're at New America working on tech.
Yeah.
How did you make that transition and why?
So I was not just the immigration person at the
Yes, indeed, you were not. I should.
I was the domestic policy advisor. Yep. I covered a range of policy issues, and I lived at the intersection of the federal agencies, all the work that we were trying to get done on education and on serving veterans and a whole range of things, and the creation of this thing called the U.S. Digital Service. Where we recruited hundreds and hundreds of amazing technologists from the Silicon Valley to come do sort of 2-year tours of duty, Peace Corps style. And I saw the impact of this tech capacity, the same know-how that people are using to build the startups that have transformed the way everybody lives and works. When you apply that talent to what government does, it's a pretty transformative thing. And I witnessed that transformation in really profound ways. I helped place some of the tech teams in the agencies and identified the projects we wanted them to work on. And what I noticed was that the world that I come from, which is the nonprofit world, the NGO community service world, really needs that capacity. And that has to change. And so it seems actually like a logical continuation of what I was doing to be part of making that change. I also have a second big part of my job is that we're creating a what's called a national network of local innovators. We're identifying innovators. We are experimenting with ways to move their ideas around and make them more visible. This is a network that we're building because we're pretty convinced that we have the capacity to renew ourselves as a country. And there are people in this country doing it every day. And the policymaking process here in Washington would benefit greatly from seeing it and learning from it.
One of the questions I often ask guests here on Women Rule is confronting risk taking,
yeah,
and the fear of failure.
Yeah.
What is your process for doing both of those things? Mm. When a challenge lies ahead of you and, you know, you start hearing the voices in your head.
Yeah. I have those voices. Yeah. I feel like I learned a lot about this in the years. I was in the administration mm-hmm. all 8 years. That's a tough place, yeah. even in the best of times. Mm-hmm. And it's scary. And I found that for the first probably year or two, I thought, man, I am not being successful in conquering fear because I feel it all the time. And finally, the sort of coach I was working with said, you know why you have fear? Because your job is scary. Mm-hmm. And fear is entirely appropriate. So that actually gave me the capacity to just let go of it and recognize that, yeah, you know, when you're working at this level, you're going to make decisions. Like, it's only the hard decisions that get, you know, that get to the senior staff of the president of the United States. And then you're teeing up the very, very hardest of them for him. That should be scary. That's, you know, part of the job. And in a weird way, that allows you to let the fear lose its hold on you.
How did you cope? I mean, when your failure in a White House is a very public failure, you know, I wrote about it, yeah. right?
Yeah.
I'm sure you were angry at me a couple of times. I don't know, maybe not. But it's a very sort of public process. Mm-hmm. And now things I do in my job, like people write stories about decisions I make.
Yeah.
In ways that I don't like or do like. How did you cope with that very sort of public spotlight yeah. on everything that you did?
I got criticized very yeah. personally.
Very personally.
From people who I knew, I had known for a long time. I actually expected that that would happen, and it did.
And how were you criticized personally?
Well, the first article, the first profile of me as an administration official that ran in the Washington Post had the headline of something along the lines of, Munoz accused of turning her back on her own community. That was the headline. I anticipated that that would happen, and I decided the day I accepted the job that, one, that it was worth doing it because I believed in the president I was working for, and I believed he was not going to ask me to do things that I didn't think were right, and I was right about that. And then I decided I was just going to have faith in my own integrity, and that if I, you know, nobody else was going to have the behind the scenes information that I had, and that if I was making the best possible decision, knowing what I knew, that was going to have to be enough. And my goal was to be able to walk out of that building knowing that I'd given it all I had and that I'd made the best possible decisions, that I did my best to correct mistakes when I made them and own up to things. And I'm proud to say I succeeded in doing that. And that's enough.
And you have the added layer of like having had that responsibility put on you by as the community. You know,
yeah.
you're a Latina.
Yep.
And people had expectations for you.
Yep.
So how did you work through that?
Yeah.
And what standard did you hold for yourself?
Yeah, I did a couple things. One is there's these moments when. Right. So I'm a civil rights mm-hmm. activist. That's how I met the president when he was a senator. Mm-hmm. He knew that that's what he was getting when he asked me to come. There is these moments when you see people around you who don't necessarily come from that environment say, all right, this is the Latina in the room and we have this decision. We're going to ask for her input. And we wonder, is she going to be an advocate or is she going to be like put the good of the team and the overall initiative first. Mm-hmm. Sometimes those are the same thing and sometimes they're not. The first time it happened when I knew I was being tested, I knew I could see that I was being tested. And, you know, my job is not always to give the advocate's view. Although sometimes you have to say, look, this is how this world is going to perceive this decision, but to apply what I know in the most honest way possible. And you know, sometimes that means that you don't take the position that folks in the advocacy world would take. They're being tactical when they're doing that. And when you're on the inside, your job is different. Your responsibility is different. It helped a lot that I knew that I was working for a president who understood those things. But not everybody around me every day did understand those things. So one test was my kind of being true to what I know. Am I making sure the people in the room with me understand what they need to know to make a good decision? There were times when I felt like I was explaining things that people were not grasping, and I wrestled really hard with how to get this point across in a way that somebody who doesn't have my experience will understand. So that was kind of one set of things I grappled with. And there were definitely times when you're dealing with really hard things. For me, the unaccompanied kids crisis in 2014 was the worst of those.
And that was when there were thousands and thousands of young people streaming over the border
by themselves
through Central America.
Yep. Mm-hmm. Kids coming alone. And where you have nothing but bad choices, and you have to kind of pick your way through and make the best possible choices among an array of really bad options. When I would go home at the end of the day, really, quite literally, and examine my conscience to make sure I felt like we had that day made the right choices so that I felt clear enough to go back and do it again the next day. And that was, for me personally, the very hardest point. And there was one point at which I actually told the president, I just want you to know I examine my conscience every single day to make sure we're doing this right. Mm-hmm. And it's really hard, but I believe we are.
Would you ever consider running for office? Have you ever?
No.
Why not?
So I'm more of a policy nerd than I am a politician.
Makes a good politician, no?
Here's some wonkiness is probably useful in a politician, but I think in order to be a really good one, you have to be an extrovert and you have to really love being out there every day, and I don't love that. I love the policy process. I respect it. I care about it, but I'm not a politician. I think those are different things.
Do you think a woman will be a nominee anytime soon?
I certainly hope so. I believe so. Lord knows we're ready for it.
Do you think 2016 and how Hillary Clinton, sort of the difficulty that accompanied that race and some of the post-election analysis about why it turned out the way it did, that either sets back the ability for a woman to capture the nomination in 2020?
No, I don't think it does. Look, some of what happened was about Hillary Clinton, the person that we had a lot of experience with that people felt like they knew and decided that they knew whether or not they really did. And some of it was just about a woman being in that position. And obviously there's huge overlap there. I was shocked at the level of misogyny, I have to say, in the campaign. And it's not like I haven't put up with it in my life. I had this conversation with my daughter. I'm the mother of two young women. And I told my daughter, who's now 25, that I was shocked at the level of misogyny. And she said, Mom, I'm not shocked. And that statement actually shocked and hurt me. You know, how is it that my kid is more aware of how ugly it is than I am? And she said, you've just been dealing with, you know, low-grade misogyny for so long, you don't see it anymore. And she was right.
So what was it about her experience that didn't shock her?
I think being a younger woman, she's coming to it fresh. She sees it more than I do, even in part because she doesn't have the experience of coming as far as we've come in my life. Like I'm in my 50s. I'm of a generation that quite literally grew up with people telling you can be a nurse or a teacher. You decide which one it is. So some of it is you get worn down from getting from there to where we are now, and she's not worn down in that way. So I think some of it is that. But I think she was right that you get numb to it so that you have the capacity to be shocked when it rears its head in the way that it did in that campaign. And I'm sorry about that, and it makes me wonder whether I've done enough to get the world where it needs to be for my girls. And so it's funny, I think of that when I reflect on the answer I just gave you about running for office. I don't think of myself as an out-in-front person. I know I'm capable of it, but it's not what I want for my life. But this is what we do. We women frequently choose to be behind the scenes. We don't like what feels like self-promotion. And I fully cop to that, and I recognize that I may be doing a disservice to the women who come after me. And I may have done a disservice to the women who come after me by being comfortable being less visible while I was at the White House. I'm the first Latina to ever be the domestic policy advisor to the president. I was the highest ranking Latina in the White House. I was the highest ranking Latina in the White House all 8 years. But I was, you know, as for the shorthand for it is I was not one of the famous people in the White House, which was fine with me. I didn't seek to be one of the famous people. But I wonder if I had sharper elbows in that regard, if I would be doing more of a service to the people who come after me. But that's just not who I am.
Yeah, like a little more self-promotion and branding and getting a following. And that's also not inherently probably who you were
close.
In your core. So it probably would have felt very uncomfortable and very distracting, right? From like what you were there to do was to like get stuff done.
Well, in fact, I had a little disdain for people who were trying to build a cult of themselves because that's not what the job is. And you could always spot people who had one eye on their next thing and the other eye on their work. I'm a person who keeps both eyes on my work, and I'm proud of that. And I think that's part of why I've been successful. Mm-hmm. But it is true that there are elements of gender to that. We are less comfortable promoting ourselves. And I think possibly that is a disservice to the women who come after.
I think you're right. I think in this, well, I mean, I think everyone has to do what feels comfortable for them. Individually, but there is this environment today where branding and promoting yourself is valued over a lot of things.
Yeah.
So why are we all so uncomfortable doing that?
Yeah.
I know I am.
Yep.
But who knows? what advice do you have for women, you know, combating like an environment like Washington, which is still obviously it's getting better.
I don't consider myself of Washington, which is a funny thing to say since I've been here 30 years. I think I'm a woman of color. I've worked at a civil rights institution for 20 of those 30 years. It's pretty hard to feel like you're at the center of things when you almost by definition, you're at the margins. And I've never lost that sense. But if I were offering advice to anyone, I would say it's incredibly important to stay true to yourself and not to get caught up in what anyone else thinks about you. That your sense of integrity is like the most important asset you have. And they're the people who let go of it for the sake of, you know, I don't know, whatever they think this town requires of them are the people who get lost. So that's like the most important thing.
Yeah. Be yourself, right?
Yeah. Be yourself and be true to what you know. And again, as I say this frequently to young people, you know, I talk to a lot of people of color who come to this town to start out their careers, and they get this look of shock when I say this, but it's true. You know stuff that the rest of this town doesn't know by virtue of who you are and where you come from, and don't ever devalue that. It's not that they're a club that you're not in. And I've at some level, I've felt that way my whole career, that there's some club here that I'm not in. But you know what? I know stuff that the rest of this town doesn't know. And they need to know it if we're going to do right by the whole country. When I say this to groups of young people, they look at me with a look of shock. Like, what do you mean I have something to bring to this? Well, of course they have something to bring to it. And it's really important. And it's incredible to me that I got to work for a president who gets that. And so many of us who served in the administration were kind of there for that reason, right? I didn't have a career trajectory that was kind of designed to lead me into the West Wing.
Mm-hmm.
I ended up at the West Wing because President Obama was a person who appreciated what I had to offer.
That's good advice. That's what I tell younger journalists. You just have to be yourself.
Yeah.
And don't compromise that.
Yeah.
And then chances are you'll be fine.
Well, and if you lose that, then who are you?
Mm-hmm.
Why did you come? You know, we're all trying to do good in the world, but it helps to do it as yourself.
Well, it was great talking with you.
Thank you so much.
Thanks for giving me the time.
This was fun.
Thank you.